Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us is retired United States Navy Vice Admiral Rick Hunt, the president and CEO of the Surface Navy Association, which will be conducting its annual conference and trade show virtually over the coming week. Rick is a former Naval Surface Forces commander who is now the president of Fincantieri Marinette Marine. We are an SNA media partner, and our coverage is sponsored by Fincantieri Marinette Marine, Leonardo DRS, and GE Marine. Rick, Happy New Year, and thanks so very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Vago. Boy, I can't believe it, 2021. So we're in a new year, new opportunities, new challenges. Our Surface Navy Association's National Symposium, as you just said, is right upon us. I believe that this will provide many insights to our most demanding issues.
So, sir, every single year, this is a great opportunity for the Navy leadership. The Chief of Naval Operations is an 1110. He's a surface warfare officer as well. And last year, he was sporting his elegant black new surface warfare jacket. We're going to hear from Admiral Schleiss, the Director of Surface Warfare, from Major General Tracy King in expeditionary warfare, as well as other leaders across the force, the SURF War as well. What's the theme for this year's conference, first of all?
Well, I think the theme is very appropriate. It's train, maintain, fight, and win. And certainly Roy Kitchener personally involved in coming up with that. It's been his focus coming from Surflant. He's certainly got the right background, and I think he's got to get those four elements right. And that's what we're going to hear an awful lot of throughout the symposium.
You're a former SURF War. I should have pointed that out as well. So you used to map out these conferences and help coordinate the messages that everybody was going to deliver. I know that you don't want to jump the gun on anything that certainly the CNO or anybody else is going to be talking about. But what do you think are going to be some of the issues that we're going to hear about from leadership?
The folks that we asked across the board to participate in the symposium were universally supportive. And so we have an all-star group, you named some of them, but we've got not only the CNO kicking off for the very first keynote speaking event on Monday morning at 9 o'clock. We've got Commandant Carl Schultz, got Admirals Davidson and Grady and Fowler. And for the Commandant, we've got Lieutenant General Louis Grabota, who is the Training Education Command. So, you know, the kind of folks that we get here are truly the leadership, not only community-wise, but across the maritime services. And that's incredibly important. Everybody wants to participate, and they're doing it in a very meaningful way. You know, I think where we're going to start is with the CNO kicking stuff off. He's going to take advantage of the opportunity, and he's actually calling in from overseas. He'll be out with the fleet, making time for starting the SNA symposium here between different events that he's doing. I think he's going to give us an update perhaps to his navigation plan, talk a little bit about how he sees things and where we're going, and frankly he didn't want to give us too much of a tipper on what he's going to do, because I think it's going to be a very impressive must listen to event that hopefully everybody out there will jump into.
You know, one of the most important things of each one of these trade shows is, you know, that there's an SNA family. There's a Navy League family, just like there's a sub-league AFA and AUSA family. And the trade show aspect of it, right? So one is the professional development and the presentations and the senior leadership messages, and then all the other events that go with it. But at the same time, the trade show part of it is very important, Rick. How are you guys creating this sort of sense of community, given that this year the program, as has been unfortunately the case because of COVID, is being presented virtually?
You know, one of the things that we did very early on, after it was clear that COVID was going to have an impact, is change our waterfront, San Diego Waterfront Symposium, to the Waterfront Symposium virtually. And we touch people all the way from Rota, Spain to Japan, and gave them the opportunity to participate. By doing that upfront, we were able to kind of develop some best practices. We listened to what industry had to give us in feedback. And so part of the reason that we are expanding from 3 days to 5 days is to make sure we don't have multiple events going on at the same time, and providing the opportunity for industry to be able to open chat rooms, have discussions, with our SNA membership to address questions, to explore further as you go into the virtual exhibits that everybody has, and perhaps participate in listening to our theater. We have an industry theater that is going to be some pretty high level demonstrations of different equipment sets, ships, that sort of thing, that I think is going to be very good in educating and setting the stage for folks as they go forward. You know, and finally, you know, there's going to be the ability to set up and register for chat periods to carry on some of those conversations. Now, it's certainly not going to be like talking directly to folks. And I would tell you, we are very committed to being as good as we can be now, but with a path to getting back to a normal event, hopefully in 2022. But we think this is going to be the best virtual trade show that people will have seen across industry. The advantage in us going virtual and recording every single event allows people to watch in time frame that they're free and they can watch. You could listen to the CNO, for example, and turn it into a training event on your ship. Two points I'll make. First one is all active duty and reserve enlisted and officers can register for the symposium at no cost. So take advantage of doing that. Secondly, the sessions will remain available after the symposium for viewing. So this is a terrific opportunity to listen to leadership across the board, to digest it, to think about it, go back, take a look if you want to study it again, and see where your Navy, your Coast Guard, your Marine Corps is going in the future. I think that is something that we cannot understate. And if there's one advantage from COVID that I see, it's getting this out, in a global way. And I think we'll keep that even when we get back to an in-person symposium here in the near future.
Rick, thanks very much. Wishing you all the best of luck and look forward to having you back on in a week to give us a little bit of the after action on some of the messages we've heard. And I want to point out to our audience that we did a great interview with you in your Fincantieri Marinette Marine capacity about the FFG 62 Constellation class frigates. So I urge people to tune in next week.
Thank you much.
And joining us today, as they do every week, are our roundtable panelists, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafia of the Teal Group Consultancy. Okay, Ron, start us off. It was a bit of a roller coaster start to the year, right? Some highs, some lows. At the end of the day, we're going to have Joe Biden, who has been officially certified as America's 46th president. What did we see over the past week when it comes to aerospace and defense?
Yeah, so I think when you look at the market, we saw a couple of things. It was a volatile week. And the volatility, I think, was more driven around the outcome of the Georgia election. And what I mean there is with the when you would call it the Democrat sweep, the market in interpreting that as greater stimulus spending, which will be good for things like construction, so on and so forth. So we saw a rebalancing in the market. It was a surprise. So for example, the bank equities, Bank of America, as an example, the day after the Georgia results happened, the Bank of America stock was up a lot, meaning 5-6%. Why was that the case? So this is the point. Two things. We saw the yield curve steepen. That's generally good for banks, and inflation expectations go up. So anything in the market that was sensitive to that went up or down as a function of that. So what that meant is we started to see a rotation out of short cycle industrials into longer cycle industrials, later cycle industrials, I guess, put it that way. Aerospace is one of the later cycle industrials. So we saw interest in later cycle industrials, aerospace. And then what was, I think, fascinating on the week was the defense stocks were volatile, but you saw some differentiation in the stocks. So this, the plays that were more sensitive to the Navy perform better than those that aren't. So Huntington Ingalls, BWX Technologies, General Dynamics did better on the week than the other defense companies. So there's I think the market's still sifting through what this all means. But I think the key is the market's expecting rates to go up. We saw that in the yield curve and more stimulus spending.
And I think some of that we tackled on the Washington panel. Michael Hurston of American Defense International, who joins us, walked us through that the composition of some of the committees. We could see Senator Blumenthal, for example, on Sea Power. You're going to have Jack Reed from Rhode Island, who's going to take over as chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and some other members. So, right, it just accentuates some of the shipbuilding states and the roles that they'll have in it. Rob Whitman obviously will remain as the ranking member of the Sea Power Committee in the House, and the chairman is Joe Courtney, also from Connecticut, who, you know, obviously General Dynamics is very important to that state. Ron, it was, you know, another big week for Boeing, but not necessarily in a good way. A lot of news flow. The company announced the closure of its Advanced Development Center at Boeing Field, really one of the true innovative technological engines of the company, developed a lot of the thermoplastic technology and a lot of the composite materials, whether it went into the B-2 bomber that was a discriminator or into the F-22 or into the 777 and then 787 and beyond. Then the company agreed to a $2.5 billion settlement with the U.S. government, admitting to fraud, but pinning it on lower staff than any malfeasance at senior ranks of the company. And then days later, just over the weekend, we saw 26-year-old 737-500 operated by Sriwijaya Air crash into the ocean during a thunderstorm after taking off from Jakarta, tragically killing all 62 aboard. Our sympathies and condolences to the families. But what did you make of all this news flow, and what does it mean for Boeing at a particularly perilous time for the company?
I would say a couple of things. From an investor perspective, there isn't a strong consensus on the stock right now. Like I said in just my previous remarks, there is a view that given the current environment that you should probably own commercial. But on Boeing itself specifically, I don't think there's a very strong consensus because of all the headlines and cross currents. On the ADC closure, the Advanced Development Center, for us, it was yet another yellow flag that doesn't give you the warm and fuzzies that they're backing away from technology and product development. And for all the reasons we've spoken before on the podcast, that I don't think that's a particularly good thing to do right now. Now, I think what Boeing would tell you is they're moving those resources to other places, so on and so forth. But it just, you know, the whole concept of having this concentrated facility where you have all the intellectual property people, that is, working together, and then you're going to disperse it and whatever, just doesn't give you the warm and fuzzies. On the deferred prosecution agreement that they settled with the Department of Justice, I think the market saw that as a moderate positive. In the end, if you look at the incremental cash cost of Boeing, it was about $750 million. And I think the interpretation of the market was kind of a slap in the wrist. And the feedback, you've seen it in the press, and you even heard this from, you know, some of the investors I talked to, you know, kind of pinning it on two pilots or two test pilots seems unrealistic. But so from that perspective, I think just purely from a financial perspective, it was seen as a modest positive because it puts it behind them at, you know, not a terrible financial cost. On the 737 crash, I mean, we don't like to, you know, talk about that and the financial implications, but I think the most important piece is it was not a MAX, it was an older aircraft. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, it is what it is. But I think right now, anything that says 737 that is negative, you can't be good from a headline perspective.
Sash, give us your take, because you'd said that if there was a third crash with something that says 737 on it, and I think that you meant Max, would have been curtains for the company. You know, what's your sense on all of this news flow, and what does it mean? And then Richard, want to get your take as well.
I definitely meant Max, even if I didn't say it quite like that. There's a huge number of 737s flying around, and some of the oldest are flying in Indonesia, and Indonesia regrettably has a very, very weak safety culture. I mean, I've flown in Indonesia on aircraft that I pretty much regretted I was flying on the moment they shut the doors. So I think it's very, very sad, but this is not a Max issue particularly. This is an Indonesian issue, and it's a very, very populous but not very rich nation that has been growing very fast, and with those things, all sorts of rules and issues get stretched, and I would put this down to that. And by the way, also the weather can be shockingly bad there as well. From my point of view, the most interesting thing that's been happening this week, looking at Europe versus the US, has been that, notwithstanding the comments that Ron made about the yield curve and so forth, the euro versus the dollar, the long-term, and I'm long-term, let's say, certainly 7-8 month trend, which has been that the dollar has been weakening against the euro, is still pretty much unbroken. And if we had a, not even buoyant, a functioning market for new civil aircraft orders, and if we had a functioning competition between the two between two manufacturers, and we don't at the moment. But if we'd had that, this would be incredibly positive for Boeing, because, strong euro, weak dollar, that has just got to make it easier for Boeing to go out and do and sell, because it hugely improves the competitiveness of any aircraft they sell against their Airbus equivalents. Problem is that we don't really have a competition at the moment, and the market's dead. But this is something to watch, because it is going to affect the profitability of the European aerospace companies, which have, if not predominantly, certainly a small majority of their costs in euros, over the next 2 to 3 years, if they are hedging at sort of 122, 125, 130, which is about the forward rate at the moment, that's not a pleasant situation for them to be in. And unless the dollar reverses strengthens very, very substantially over the next 3 to 4 months or so, European aerospace companies are going to be feeling the pinch.
Richard, your take on Boeing's week?
Boy, I don't have a lot to add relative to Ron. I would strongly endorse the view that this is an Indonesian problem, not a 737 problem. Matter of fact, you go back to the Indonesian government report coming out of the Lion Air crash, and it was shockingly honest. And there were two problems. One was design and integration of MCAS, and the other was Indonesia's SASHA safety culture. I'm confident the first of those have been dealt with. I'm much less confident about the second, and I think they need to start dealing with it. So no impact there to Boeing, I don't think. I agree completely with Ron. The most bizarre aspect to me of the $2.5 billion was the $1.77 in customer concessions and whatever. That's really not a place that government is typically involved, and I don't think they were this time. They were simply grabbing 15% of what Boeing was paying to customers anyway, and said, oh, look, we made them do this. We should deserve credit for enforcing safety, which is as Orwellian as it gets in its own way. And I agree completely with Ron. I mean, this is they say never let a crisis go to waste. Well, they're not wasting this crisis. They're using it as an opportunity to badly diminish their ability to create future products and lose market share to Airbus. They really need leadership. They just very badly need leadership. And, you can't just look at the closing of the center on its own. You have to see it with cutbacks in IRAD, firings of engineers, and of course the closure of Boeing Next and the cutbacks to Horizon X. Everything they seem to be shooting for as an engineering company seems to be something they're eager to put behind them.
And what did you make of the settlement?
Well, just that, of the one beyond the financial part, which seemed like complete nonsense, you know, $243 million in actual penalties, another chunk going to families, which, as I believe Ron said, is that's what you pay. Yeah, you have to pay that. And the other $1.77 billion being completely ridiculous and nothing to do with anything that the government mandated.
Just tell the audience what the other $1.7 billion was.
Yeah, it was something called, correct me if I'm wrong, customer concessions or payments to customers but they're paying what? What are we up to? 10, 12, 15 billion? I mean, that's something that is determined by angry customers telling them what they need to pay. The idea that this should be in a government press release is just bizarre.
Right.
Now, in terms of ramifications, I would like a serious conversation, and I have for years, so has I know Ron, and I think Sash feels this too, a conversation about Boeing's culture, the access its engineering and technical people have to top levels of management, both in terms of, well, executives and most importantly, the board, which until recently was completely devoid of anything resembling engineering and technical educational backgrounds. And even now, it's just a couple of add-ons. There needs to be a broader conversation. You can have that broad and important conversation, or you can find two random pilots and blame them because they were discovered saying things that didn't look good in various communiques. I don't really like this at all.
Yeah, I mean, I would add Bago, right?
Go ahead.
As we know, I mean, the pressure to keep the certification between the airplanes similar on training was huge, right? That wasn't just, two pilots, right? So, the communication between two pilots that, didn't look right. It's just, seemingly unbelievable. That's just two bad actors that were behind this whole thing. I mean, that just seems completely unrealistic, right?
The context in which it took place, where you had an engineering company, but when the MAX was developed, the head of the commercial unit didn't have any kind of engineering background. The head of the entire corporation, the CEO, did not have even the vaguest resemblance to an engineering or technical background. And that would have been fine as long as you had a board with people who were technically qualified, except, oh my dear God, it was Nikki Haley and a few other random folks. I mean, it's just bizarre that they're not having any kind of deeper soul searching other than blaming two pilots.
Which I also think was interesting because, it was those test pilots that are the ones who said, hey, here's the problem with the airplane. So it's sort of interesting that somehow they'd be the ones, that the community that actually seems to have laid out the concerns or made public the concerns were the ones who ultimately, are somehow being, or at least that community is somehow being blamed is certainly kind of bizarre.
Now, the one thing we didn't mention that I think is important to mention is the potential reputational harm that all this has. I mean, ultimately, right? I mean, the customers aren't, they weren't born yesterday, right? I mean, most of the world wasn't born yesterday. So even though from a legal perspective and a financial perspective, this is getting pinned on, two employees, it's not that the customer base and anybody else, there's a reputational hit here, right? And not to say that there could be other legal action taken by others impacted by this. This is just with the DOJ on this one thing. But from a financial perspective, it was clearly a win for Boeing because it wasn't really all that much.
Sash, let's go and get a sense on Airbus's 2020 deliveries and order update. We had a rough estimate, but now the company has come up with that. And also talk to us a little bit about Rolls-Royce and UltraFan and what that means, because in some respects, that's an even more important story than what we saw with Airbus.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, Airbus, first of all, Airbus orders and deliveries, deliveries and orders, actually, 566 deliveries last year, a really impressive performance. They had, back in the middle of the year, they'd said, oh, we hope we can do sort of around 500. Then they edged that up at the 9-month stage. But, this was 20, 30 aircraft above, I think, what even the company's expectations were before about the end of November. Two really interesting issues that come out of it. One is that, having had a very, very strong 2020 relative to what people's expectations were 6 months ago, certainly, you would expect there to be a bit of pressure on Airbus and say, you know, you're doing so well, why can't you continue this? Or, you know, can't you continue this? Can't you improve on this? And the statement read, based on our 2022 deliveries, we're cautiously optimistic as we look into 2021, although challenges and uncertainties remain high in the short term. And it's very interesting, if you look at some of the, you know, comments on, you know, Reuters and Bloomberg, the company is trying very hard to push back on the idea that they will raise production rates of the A320. You remember we had that story a couple of months ago that A320 production would go from 40 a month to 47 a month. I don't think the company wants that story out there at the moment. And it seems to me that, you know, the production rate rise, although they continue to, and they use the word protect it, that that's a, I don't know, N21, beginning 22 story, if that. Second issue is really interesting about the deliveries last year, and I think explains most of the beat, is the degree to which Airbus really turned the thumbscrews on the leasing companies. And the way that you can see this is that normally every single aircraft that Airbus delivers to a leasing company has, in brackets beside it, the airline that that was delivered onto. So, you know, the delivery to the leasing company is purely theoretical because that's an aircraft painted in an airline colors. The leasing company is just a financier. Not in 2020 that was the case. There were 20 aircraft that I can count that were delivered to leasing companies where the leasing company did not have a customer for it. Now, it's entirely possible come January the 2nd, January the 3rd, that those aircraft get delivered on. But the most number of aircraft I've ever been able to find, and I've been tracking this for 20 years now for Airbus, that I've ever been able to find where they deliver to a leasing company, the leasing company did not have an onward customer, was three. So what that tells you is that Airbus said to the leasing companies, it's pay time. You have to take delivery of the stuff you have on order. You get a good deal on pricing, but you've got to pony out the cash. And I would suggest to you that's how they, you know, achieved this beat last year. Really, really interesting. I wonder whether they can repeat that in 2021. Actually, I don't. They can't.
And what about Rolls-Royce and UltraFan?
Okay, yeah, sorry. This is another story, but it's got Airbus ramifications. Very, very good Financial Times story. UltraFan is Rolls-Royce's... I'm trying to use a phrase that's not going to run into trademark and patent problems, but yeah, that's really hard. It's their design for a geared fan. But unlike Pratt & Whitney with the trademark geared turbofan, which is currently a narrow body engine, Rolls-Royce's UltraFan is a big beast. It's designed for a wide body. And they've been working on it for 5+ years now, probably longer than that. And the FT story was that once UltraFan is tested and proved to work, which is, you know, in the next couple of years or so, they're going to put it on ice. Why are they going to put it on ice? Because they've got, you know, nobody wants to launch a new aircraft or even a new re-engining at the moment. And, you know, the real story is Rolls-Royce cannot afford to keep the design team and the whole design process going when there's no near-term end market for an engine like this. And this is a function of the fact that the wide-body market is absolutely on its back at the moment. What I think is interesting, longer term, but I mean, this is a five-year prospect, is that at some stage, Airbus is going to re-engine the A350. And Richard and I, because we already have done, we'll disagree a lot on the timing of this and even more on the on the connotations you might attach to this. But I would suggest that an UltraFan engined A350 were Airbus to do it, because it's likely to be, certainly in terms of design, currently the only very, very advanced wide-body engine, would make the 777X look pretty anemic and probably do quite a lot of damage to the 787 as well. But Airbus doesn't need to do that at the moment. They're delivering A350s at 4 or 5 a month, and there's no end demand that they can stimulate with a new aircraft or a re-engined aircraft at the moment. So in the short term, the Rolls-Royce design teams are going to be wound down. It's a very similar story and a very sad story, but very similar to what we were just talking about with Boeing.
Richard and Ron, your guys' view on that news flow, both at Airbus and the implications for Rolls. Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I viewed it as more of an ecumenical approach. I mean, I'll let Sash tell me I'm wrong, and it's possible I am, but I thought it was a technology initially aimed at Twin Isle large fans, but ultimately one that could, you know, have implications for the lower end too, and possibly even a Boeing, you know, 757 class aircraft, the plane that we've all been advocating for some time now. And it's the absence of that that I think is perhaps most depressing, that they don't even see that as a near to medium term possibility for a product launch. And, you know, on top of that, I sort of, you know, there was always that talk for 4 years now, there's been talk of a 350 re-engineering, which is just bizarre for a brand new aircraft. And originally the rumors were that Airbus had discussed things with GE, and that might've been the revelation, of course, that came out with the GE disclosures or financial results the other day, I believe, that there was some kind of conversation. And that's the kind of conversation you'd be having if your brand new aircraft needed a re-engineering at some ridiculously early stage in its life. So what Rolls-Royce thought they could do in that process, you know, who at Airbus would say, well, okay, that's gone horribly wrong. Let's use them again. That doesn't make a great deal of sense, but who knows? Maybe they really did have a product that worked pretty compelling for a re-engined aircraft.
Ron?
Yeah, I would
mention. Hang on. Sash, I'll come back to you right after Ron finishes his point, and you can finish that up if that works for you. Okay, 3, 2, 1. Ron?
The point I would follow up on is Sash's point on the Airbus deliveries. You know, I think he's 100% right on with the exposure to lessors. That was the one thing that really jumped out at me when I looked at, you know, not only, you know, the delivery profile, the number of deliveries to lessors, and who the airplanes ended up going to or not in those deliveries. And you really do have to wonder as you get into this next year with, you know, some advanced time for lessors to do some delivery slot management, if they'll be able to do that again this year. So I just kind of seconding Sasha's remarks on that.
Sash, did you have one follow-up point you'd like to make?
Yeah, just really quickly. I mean, on roles, but actually more on, you know, relationships between the airframe and engine OEMs. Richard's absolutely right. You know, the UltraFan is designed to, or has been designed to be scalable down into the narrow body segment of the market. I always worry. I mean, one of my absolute hate words in this industry is when people use the word just, you know, it's just a stretch. It's just a shrink. It's just a scaling up, just a scaling down. That tends to come from management and from salesmen who either willfully or ignorantly underestimate the real technical risk of what they're talking about. It's a real alarm word for me. But you know, as currently being built, UltraFan is a small wide body scale engine. But yeah, you know, Rolls would hope that the technology would be usable thereafter. And as far as why would Airbus, you know, go and use the engine maker who let them down in the first place? And it's a really good point. But even everybody likes loves a sinner who repenteth, and everybody loves an engine company that goes back and tries just a bit harder, whether it's on technology or on price. And you know, we are all can remember the time when the worst engine company on Airbus's list was Pratt & Whitney. Pratt & Whitney, right, who let them down big time on the PW6000 in particular. John Leahy was going around saying he would never have Pratt & Whitney on their aircraft ever again. And then the Geared Turbofan came along and history was changed.
The only thing I remember about just is McDonnell Douglas telling everybody that the Super Hornet was just an upgraded Hornet. Just has that connotation for me. Wait a minute, but 85% of everything is different in this jet than a regular Hornet. So I always thought
QED.
Yeah, exactly. Sash, big news for Britain this week. Obviously, first full week of Brexit. A lot of discussions, good and bad, on how that went. I leave that to you as an objective observer, right? You'd mentioned, for example, that you were a little bit worried about the financial sector and where trades might go. And we did see some trades migrate away from London to Amsterdam and to Paris, pretty much exactly as you'd anticipated, as well as a couple of other challenges. Obviously, a very, very bad coronavirus period for the country. And on top of all of that, I think maybe even the more important story, not to minimize the pandemic impact, is the prime minister's apparent decision to change the chief of defense staff, Sir Nick Carter, former British Army chief, now serving in that role. For some, he's a visionary. For others, he's been mismanaging the force. You know, at the end of the day, give us your sense on all three of these stories.
Okay, Brexit very quickly. You're absolutely right. You know, the story of Brexit this week, you know, paradoxically, it wasn't sort of massive, outrageous customs queues. There are clearly all sorts of problems, but there's not a huge amount traveling through the ports anyway at the moment. But it was that a huge amount of financial share dealing moved from London to Europe pretty much at the flick of a switch, because that's how the regulations now work. And the City of London is going to have to work like stink to devise ways to attract dealing, and also to come up with different financial instruments that makes the city or continues to make the city somewhere that is super attractive for international companies to do their business. That really was very, very interesting indeed. Coronavirus, I have to say, the news coverage in the UK has all been about coronavirus. But you know, you have to read the FT to actually get the European share dealing stuff. UK defence, I'm not a great fan of General Sir Nick Carter. My concern, certainly, in a medium like this, is that firstly, the British Army's record has been very, very bad, and he has been towards or at the top of it for about the last decade. But, you know, the British Army, in terms of recent wars, played two, lost two, and they were big. And the Army has done very, very badly in those wars. But more importantly, the Army has probably refused to accept that we lost, and we lost big time. You know, we failed to deliver what we as an army said we would achieve, and I'm a former reservist, I feel entirely entitled to say this, and we really mismanaged those processes. But I think more importantly has been the restructuring of the British Army in the last 7-8 years or so, and this is where I think General Carter had his chance and has not delivered on it. He's the person who has been really focused on various forms of next generation army, currently Army 2025, I think, but you know, the number typically changes every couple of years. It was certainly Army 2020. He invented the concept of the strike brigades. The strike brigades bear a horrible resemblance to US future combat system. You remember that see first, decide first, strike first, or whatever it was. That was a concept that, you know, came a horrible cropper in Iraq in particular, where we discovered that incoming fire has right of way and the enemy always has a turn. The British Army is going down a lot of the same sad direction, and mismanaging its armored vehicle fleet and mismanaging its armored vehicle program. So, but I think the biggest problem with Carter has been that he's a visionary. To someone who is not a defense specialist, he speaks with jargon that is almost impenetrable. And ultimately, I don't think the military can afford to distance themselves from the civilians that they serve and the civilians that they protect in that way anymore. So he's had his chance. He's been chief of the defense staff for a couple of years. That's the normal term. And it looks from very well-sourced article in the London Sunday Times as if he won't get an extension of the, you know, Boris Johnson said he won't get an extension of that. And therefore it will then be a very, very interesting competition between two other soldiers, Patrick Sandford and Mark Carleton-Smith. The Navy, I think quite understandably, rather feels that not having had a chief of the defense staff since 2003, it might just be their turn. And given that the focus of investment over the next 10 years is going to be on the Navy, whether it's ballistic missile submarines or carrier strike or new frigates, I'm inclined to believe that, you know, the Navy should have a go. And actually, the Army should probably focus on trying to sort out its own procurement programs and get its budget back in order. And I say that as a soldier.
The United States military is asking some of those same questions, Sash, right? I mean, I don't think it was just a failure of the British Army. I think everybody is looking at Iraq and Afghanistan and asking themselves the very, very same hard questions. And there are those who would say that Tony Radakin, the first Sea Lord, is somebody who is you know, very, very good leader, very thoughtful, has got a program that's coming together. Although there are those very, very disturbing Telegraph story, I think it was, wasn't it, about leaks aboard Prince of Wales, which is somewhat disappointing. Do you think Wigston is completely out, the RAF chief of their staff?
I honestly think it's far too early to say at the moment. I think that the race has, well, it's not that the race has only just started, because everybody starts the race from a different position. It's not like a normal race where there's actually fixed starting blocks. I think that, you know, the Navy is the focus of procurement over the next decade, probably, and arguably one of the focuses of UK foreign policy in a broader sense. You have to make a very good case as to why it is that the Army keeps on being, chief of the defense staff.
Right. And I should have said Mike Wigston is who we're talking about in terms of chief of the Royal Air Force. Let me ask everybody about a broader question about China. We are in an extraordinary situation where an American administration is coming into office while China has been racing to lock up deals, putting an enormous amount of pressure on Europe and Asia to see the world its way. Asia and Europe signed trade deals that box Joe Biden in on the one hand, and immediately after doing so, Chinese leaders then crack down on Hong Kong's democracy movement. And it seems as though the Chinese always do this to sort of underscore the fact that they will not be constrained by language, for example, that talks about human rights at the end of the day. I mean, it's astonishing to me that anybody strikes any deals with China, in part because the Chinese so habitually violate every single one of these deals. And the Chinese also want to not only play lip service to human rights, but also be able to want to underscore to everybody, hey, Japan, I'll cut off your rare earths, and Germany, be on best behavior, because BMW shipments are governed not by market forces, but whether I'm unhappy with you. Look what's happened with World Health Organization investigators that have shown up in China, right? There's some visa problem, which is why they can't enter the country to sort of investigate that. How do you guys sense that this is all going to play as an issue going forward? Because the Biden administration is trying to balance how it can cooperate and where it can be tough. And it seems as though the Chinese are doing an excellent game to try to steer the Biden team into nothing to see here on competition, nothing to see here on being tough. If you know what's good for you, you'll drop these sanctions and the like. Ron, do you want to start us off, Richard, and then Sash?
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, a couple thoughts. Just, you know, just focus the aperture on commercial aerospace. Like we've said before in the past, the Chinese commercial aerospace market is, you know, one of the most important markets in the world. When you look at the, you know, the narrow body market in China, in aggregate, it's probably about, you know, 20% of world demand. So for Boeing or Airbus, it's a very important market. And for wide bodies, it's an important place. So on that level, how this plays out with the next administration is important. If I step back and do a little bit of, you know, armchair quarterbacking, it really does seem like, you know, the Chinese are setting up things to test the next administration as the next administration comes into play. And it doesn't seem like they're making it any easier for them. So, I'll leave it up to my two colleagues to discuss, you know, how that could play out. But, you know, but ultimately, you know, they're not setting it up as an easy pass for the Biden administration.
Richard?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And of course, you know, the PRC government is, this is their strategy, divide and conquer. And the Trump folks played right into it by doing, you know, almost making a perversely systematic effort at alienating potential allies and not supporting allies when they got in trouble with similar China trade policies. In other words, we're kind of reaping what we've sowed here in terms of the EU and China trade agreements. From a commercial aero standpoint, turning it back to home, you know, the likely upshot, if something can't be done, of course, is a significant shift towards Airbus and away from Boeing. That's not good from Boeing's standpoint. And what can the Biden folks do? They're definitely, this decision just a couple of days ago, or this move a couple of days ago, to hold U.S. companies liable in Chinese courts for agreeing to U.S. the new U.S. Military end user list, for example, that implies nothing good. So basically, the idea of the Biden folks being able to effect a reconciliation with China, not looking all that likely at all. The most they can do is start working with allies. I strongly recommend Australia, Canada, and South Korea being a great start, followed by Japan and the EU, and seeing if the united front, this, you know, the sort of assembly of democracies, I think was one term that had been thrown around, and who knows, maybe there's something to it. But the only thing that could be done is to prevent the Chinese from doing the divide and conquer thing here.
I mean, that's kind of the big question I've got, right? Is are they setting the table so that nobody actually will have the energy to fight them, which I think is the whole idea, right? I mean, it's very Sun Tzu, win without fighting is ultimately, I think, what China's interested in doing. But Sash, I want to get your sense as well, because Europe is very divided on it. On the one hand, right, there are folks who say, you know what, relying on Huawei for 5G probably was not a very good idea, nor being dependent on Chinese technologies. But at the same time, you have a post-Brexit England, which was talking about more trade with China at the end of the day anyway. Europeans looking at more trade with China and recognizing that if you piss the Chinese off, all of a sudden you'll have a lot of Mercedes-Benz and machine tools and anything else piling up in your factories, right? I mean, we saw a Chinese acquisition of one of Germany's leading machine tool makers, which also is problematic, depending on how you want to look at it. I mean, what's the sense there? I mean, is there any fight against China, or is China actually going to be pandered to, in a sense, because everybody is worried about the economic damage, especially coming out of the pandemic, which was a little bit of the Chinese strategy?
Short term, that's the key theme, isn't it? I mean, Europe, or rather the EU, signed a huge investment deal with China last week, and that was driven by the fact that Europe needs China as a market, and secondarily, but you know, it, for some countries, still significantly needs Chinese investment into Europe. You're absolutely right about the UK, although I would point out that was two chancellors ago now, so right. that feels a terribly long time ago. I think the UK is probably rather more hawkish on China, although whether that actually means that we can do very much, particularly about Hong Kong, I regret to say probably not. But you know, do remember that one of the focuses of the next big Royal Navy, you know, round the world cruise is going to be freedom of navigation operations in the South China Seas. Those are going to be quite interesting to watch, frankly. But I don't think there's going to be it's hard enough to get a unified European view on anything at the moment. And on China, you know, nobody's going to go the extra mile to bring all the Europeans together at the moment. And, you know, from the point of view of Airbus, China has been a third of Airbus's deliveries in over the last decade. So, you know, France and Germany focus very, very heavily on that.
Question for all three of you. We saw an unprecedented attack on the U.S. Capitol. The last time that happened, Sash, I think you'll remember, was foreign forces burned it down. Never before have Americans attacked the Capitol directly, and certainly it never has.
I'm not that old, Vargo.
No.
I'm not that old.
I understand that. I understand it. But for some who might remember, it may have been British. I remember being at the White House when Her Majesty was there. And, you know, she said, I remember so many fond visits here, but I also appreciate. And at the time, the White House had been was under renovation. So all the paint was missing and you could see the scorch marks on the windows behind her, or I should say, in front of her. And she wryly noted that, you know, and British visits here have been overwhelmingly pleasant, although I acknowledge not all of them have been as pleasant, which was a joke that only a British monarch could get away with, given that forces under her predecessor's command were the ones who actually burned it. The president is under fire, but there's this sense that it's going to be very, very hard to hold him to account, given that he's leaving office in about 11 days. Do any of you guys see any sort of lasting economic or financial implications of what we're seeing, especially if this kind of right-wing disinformation-fueled violence continues. There's going to be an armed march, or at least one is planned on January the 17th. There's another one apparently planned for January the 20th to coincide with the inauguration. And the group that was involved in this that got away largely without any punishment, right? I mean, it's law enforcement officials are already saying, we didn't arrest them while they were there. It's very unlikely we're going to arrest all but sort of handfuls of people at the end of the day. What's your guys' sense? I mean, is there any sort of lasting impact from this? Sasha, I understand you may want to stay out of this one, aside from, you know, maybe the optics of it, if you can give us your sense as we go through. But Ron, give us your sense, and Richard, yours, whether you guys see any broader impact on this, or is the market just looking at this as, eh?
The short-term response from the market was surprisingly benign. When it was playing out, the market pulled down some off of its high, but closed that day up and then remained relatively buoyant the rest of the week. So from a shorter term perspective, and don't forget the market tends to take a shorter term perspective. It hasn't discounted in much. That being said, however, I think the point you do have to look at is, what does this mean from the broader international perspective when you think about not just a new administration, but anybody that's a multinational playing in different parts of the world? Does it make that work harder when other countries look at the U.S. potentially in a different light? And in particular, when you do have this, fight of ideology, if you will, between, the U.S. and China. In some circles, this might be perceived as a strengthening of China's hand. And what does that mean ultimately in the broader decoupling, particularly at the high end of the market for technology, between the U.S. and China? I guess that's how I think about it in a longer term perspective. But my sense is that's not what the market's thinking today.
Richard, any sense? And then maybe the global look of this. Sash, go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, it was certainly one of the ugliest days ever. My brother-in-law is a DC cop, and the whole thing was just an absolutely horrible experience. I think if everyone agrees that, except for the small group of traitors, losers, and random swine who were part of this. My biggest fear from a parochial Arrow Markets perspective is that what we saw with Lisa Murkowski later this week, there's more likely to be a fracture within the Republican Party, people who put up with nonsense like this and people who say, no, and I have nothing in common with these people. It could be that this becomes a worse problem, in which case, frankly, the positive impact that the Republican Party has had on defense budgets might be diluted. That I think is something that needs to be concerned. And in other words, I check out Ron's research showing the importance of mixed governments in terms of favorable defense budgets. Mm-hmm. You really do need an effective, functioning, and significantly powerful Republican Party to make that model work. And if the Republican Party fragments, it's that much harder. And the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is going to be empowered and call for significant defense cuts.
Sash, your sense is somebody sitting over there who's a fan of American democracy?
Deep shock, deep sadness at the events of this week. Richard's absolutely right. Democracies are absolutely dependent on two things. One is at least two sides of the argument that compete to for the public's approval, and a peaceful transition between one and the other. Every time there's an election, it's pretty simple stuff. This week was a very, very sad week for all of us, who know and love the US, and we wish you well.
Very quickly, Ron, 13th annual Defense and Aerospace Conference by Bank of America. I'm honored to have played a role in this, in sort of, helping start it and then co-moderating all of these years. Richard, you were a key participant as well. From your standpoint, Ron, really quickly, what were some of the key takeaways?
On the defense side, one, in previous years, there was the discussion around China as being a potential adversary. I think this year was across the board agreement that it is. It went from potential to is. Right. I think that's one point. I think a second point was, and I fear that this might be a little bit optimistic. Most of the speakers about defense budget levels were talking about flattish budgets, inflationary growth, that kind of thing. And I fear, given all the stimulus and so on and so forth, that it might play out to be a little bit worse than that. On the third point, I would say most of the speakers were talking about not that big a change in defense priorities, but maybe a change in execution, right? Maybe having a more diplomatic touch, so on and so forth. But the broader priorities, the projection of force into the Pacific, so on and so forth, that we're not going to see probably any really, really big surprises there. I'd say on the commercial side, the one point that jumped out at me was across the various presenters, there really wasn't a consensus view on the recovery. Some folks were more bullish on when we'd see air traffic get back to 2019 levels, say kind of 2022, that timeframe. And some folks were more bearish that you'd see it maybe more like 2024. And that was all driven by kind of the next point. There's still some uncertainty around how business travel is going to recover and how that plays out, and particularly around the component of business travel that has to do with not customer-facing travel, but more intra-company travel, where I would travel to another Bank of America office for a meeting. Maybe I won't do that anymore, and maybe I'll do that on Zoom. We'll see how that plays out. But it turns out it seems like that's maybe 20 to 30% of business travel. And since business travel is about something like half of airline profitability, that's a material thing to think about. The third point I'd say is just unanimously, everybody thought that Boeing should be doing a new aircraft to counter what's going on with the success of the Airbus A321 program, in particular the A321 LR and XLR. And then maybe the fourth point would be on the commercial side. The business jet market has been relatively robust compared to all other things in large commercial aero. And just the question around, will that be sustained as the vaccines roll out and people move back into just the traditional airlines? Is there a component of that business travel that shifted to private travel because the commercial piece, the commercial airlines were too inconvenient and the service was too restricted? We'll see how that plays out, right? I mean, there's two sides of that coin. Like, once you take a bite of that apple, you actually don't want to give it up, but we'll see how that goes. I would say that. I mean, you were there. I mean, are there any takeaways that you think I missed?
No, I mean, I think that was on the mark, right? I mean, in terms of the threat, in terms of the budgetary dynamic, and I agree with you, right? I mean, the most interesting thing was, to a degree, the lack of consensus. Richard was, I think, a little more bullish about where he thought commercial air travel was going to go in terms of a late 2022 event. But, from some of the other speakers, there was a little bit of concern, like, hey, look, even with vaccines and anything else, when is this going to come back? And to the broader point, right, not just recover, but then heal, right? At what point does the industry heal move ahead from recovery mode to something that's more along the lines of normalcy? So completely agreed. But it was a terrific conference.
Robert Pierce from NASA, I think his point of view, and to those engineers out there, I think this rings very clearly. When you have a very complex system, which air travel is, and it gets thrown out of equilibrium, for it to find equilibrium again can take some time. And I think that was a very concise way to look at it.
Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Always a pleasure. Have a great week and look forward to having you guys back on again next week.
Always a pleasure, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks so much, Vago.
Really appreciate it, Vago. Great to be on. Thanks.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.